Blog Talk Radio.
Hey everybody, it's Rebooting the News. God, they shortened that. Did you notice that, Jay? A little shorter. Well, anyway. Jim Rosen, you there?
I'm here, Dave.
That's good. And Jennifer Preston, that's the New York Times. That's the way I usually get this started, with a lot of confusion. Jennifer, how are you today?
I'm fine, thank you, Dave.
Awesome. So,
Jennifer Preston is the social media editor of the New York Times, and we asked her to join us on Rebooting the News today because we have many puzzles and problems in common. Isn't that correct, Jennifer?
A great way to put it. Great way to put it.
Well, why don't we get right to it, Dave?
Okay, go ahead.
Well, I think one thing we want to start with, because we've both been, or all three of us have been interested and even a little bit preoccupied with them, is the development of Twitter lists. And, whoa, what the heck is that?
Is that you or me?
I don't know.
Just keep going. Just go right through it.
I don't know what that is. Hello?
Jay, are you there?
Jay?
Okay, well, let me pick it up. Yeah, I'm here. Are you there, Jennifer?
Yes. Yes.
Okay. This is the roughest start we've ever had to this show. Anyway, so as Jay was saying, we're interested in Twitter lists. And so we asked if there was somebody from the New York Times that could talk with us about that. And we're very happy to have you here. So tell us, why is the New York Times making content for Twitter?
Well, I think that the New York Times is making content for our users, and we were able to, in the last few weeks, you know, using this new feature that Twitter offers its users, we've made about 60 lists, and in all different departments, from our sports reporters, sports. We have a cycling list, we have an NFL football list, we have a college football list. We have lists for books, lists for the arts, a Broadway list. So it
basically covers everything that the New York Times is interested in.
Well, yes. It's a start. It's a start. And what you know we found is that for the users of our website, you know, on Thursday there was the tragic shooting, as we all know, in Fort Hood, and we very quickly made a Fort Hood shooting list, which allowed our users just to keep up with the same sources that our reporters at that time, you know, were using.
Could you explain, Jennifer, why the Times is interested in making these lists? What is the journalistic rationale there?
Well, I think for two reasons. You know, what we saw on Thursday with the Fort Hood shooting list is that we were able to not only create a list and put a link to the list with the lead blog, where we were trying to give our readers and our users like live updates to what was happening, but we were also able to put that list into a little module that we were able to put right there on the blog. So in terms of real time, you know, it's a crude tool, but you know, it was a way again just to give folks like a sense of what was happening. You know,
but
right,
what's interesting
right
is the perspective is that you are providing a resource to your readers, or I don't know if you said users. But why isn't it the other way? Why isn't it a way for the users to communicate with you? I mean, wouldn't it be possible that some of the people that are, you know, on Twitter are right there in Fort Hood and have access to information that your reporters don't have access to?
Yes, and that's the whole idea, why we, behind, like, putting up this Twitter list. One of the things, though, that we learned from that breaking news experience
Let me just ask you a follow-up on that. Would you put the user on the Fort Hood list? Let's say, I mean, what are the sources that are on the Fort Hood list? Are they news organizations or, I mean, how does that work?
Yeah, and I think that, again, this is all new for many of us, which is like over the weekend, several of us were just like sharing our experience and just trying to share some best practices. I mean, for us, this is a couple of lessons learned. Number one, on a big breaking news story like that, it's best to go right out of the box with the local news organizations right on the ground. And the Killeen Daily Herald was doing a terrific job. There were, you know, a handful of local television, radio stations, and of course, like the Austin Statesman, they had their own Fort Hood shooting Twitter feed up.
Interesting.
Immediately. So
let me ask you another. Would you normally, let's say the pre-Twitter days, would you have had a relationship with these news organizations, or an electronic link to them, or how would that have worked?
Well, prior to Twitter lists, we've of course used like the Publish2 tools, and we have what we call like
I don't know what those are. What are those
tools? Okay, they're like. It's a wonderful tool, and it's a module that we have on many of our blogs, for example, that gives our readers, you know, like what we're reading. So, you know, we've had blog runner modules, you know, as you know. So the concept is not new. We have blog roles on so many of our blogs, so that you're not just getting content from, let's say, our Green Ink, you know, content that we're creating for our blog, but as part of what we're bringing to our readers, to our users, is, you know, these are the other blogs that we're looking at, and that in addition to that, using these, you know, terrific Publish2 tools. We also have on a couple of blogs what we call like what we're reading, like what very specific, you know, blog posts we're reading, or what very specific article somewhere that our journalists are reading. And so Twitter lists, you know, and this Twitter module is just like another way of just like sharing, you know, information that that we're using to create our content. And you know, like Thursday night, it was like very interesting just watching like the whole process like unfold on the web, and how, you know, we started out with this Twitter list, and then our lead blog was giving people, you know, live updates, and then because I sit right in the middle of the continuous news desk right there, and then Maria Newman, you know, and Liz Robbins were writing like the breaking story, and then around 10 o'clock Jim Dowes, who covers the military for us, then his piece, you know, landed on the website, which was like a very smart, well reported, deeply reported piece that looked at Dr. Nassan and like who this, you know, shooter was, and what were the events that may have, you know, led up to that tragic moment. And then, you know, then you had like Bob McFadden's, you know, lead all, which is a lead all at the New York Times is the story where all of the elements come in. Then that came onto the website like around 11 o'clock. So it was just like very interesting just to see, you know, like how the story evolved, and to see how we were able just to give our readers, you know, that opportunity just to join us in the process.
Okay, Jennifer, let me comment a little bit on what you just said. It's a very interesting description. Thank you for that. First, it's interesting that you're not just sharing what you have learned, but you're sharing the sources from which you learned it, right? That's
correct.
Part of what you're telling us is we're not only going to give you the news, we're going to give you the sources that we're checking to get updates and to get the latest information. So that itself is a shift from a few years ago where news organizations didn't do that. The second thing I think is really interesting about what you said is last week a very famous anthropologist, Claude Lévi-Strauss, died. He was one of the most famous anthropologists of his generation and a really smart guy. And one of the most central notions in his work was to look at cultural behavior through the lens of a particular distinction the raw and the cooked.
Mm-hmm.
And part of what you just described is a system where somebody watching the Times website as this story unfolded would see a series of presentations that range from the raw to the more cooked or finished pieces, because that's what you're describing. Initially, it's
exactly.
just kind of raw information as well as the raw sources of information, and then the lead blog puts it into some sort of form, but that's still pretty rough, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then an initial story comes out that two reporters who are working on a breaking news desk compose, and then, as you said, the military correspondent weighs in, and then Robert McFadden comes in with a fully cooked sort of introduction on which you are going to place many other pieces of a full presentation for tomorrow's paper, right?
And I didn't even mention, of course, all of the multimedia elements that are now, you know, part of every presentation on our website, like, and how that evolved into, like, the interactive feature with the victims, you know,
right.
And
so there's
like
all that material as well, right?
And then the interactive, you know, graphic where people could actually see, like on our website, like how it all unfolded. It was just very interesting for me just to see it like evolve
mm-hmm.
in one evening from reports from the Killeen Daily Herald, which I got to tell you, they did a terrific job. There at the Killeen Daily Herald, you know, the Killeen Daily Herald was right there on our website, you know, to Bob McFadden, you know, mm-hmm. by 11 o'clock at night.
Mm-hmm.
And let's not forget the printed paper the next day, right?
Right, which is even more cooked.
Yes.
Right. Could you back up a little bit and maybe talk to us about how Twitter is being used at the New York Times and how it's changing the New York Times and how the people who have taken to it in your newsroom have taken to it and why. Because I think it's an interesting story in itself, the embrace of Twitter by some and sort of the arc of its evolution within the newsroom.
Well, and you know, and just one other point that I think is important to make. You know, on day one, we were going to, like, the news organizations, the local news organizations on the ground, because when you're a reporter, you want to get, you know, as close to the scene as you can. What we could have, should have done, and what we would probably do with on a story like this next time is then try to get more of the voices, what Dave was talking about, like more of like the people who were directly affected, you know, by this tragedy, to get their voices into a Twitter list, because I think that would have been very powerful.
I don't think this story is that important, though. I mean, you know, there's a bigger picture, sort of like, how does, I mean, Jay asked not about this story. Jay asked about how does the newsroom function differently with Twitter specifically? Yeah, I mean, we see them there, you know, I mean, from our point of view, Jennifer, I mean, I've never watched, and I don't think I actually am watching New York Times people work. There are some people in some areas where I do think that is what I'm seeing, like, you know, but not many of them. I think that there's another... If that's happening somewhere else. But here, you know, what I'm thinking about is you're talking about this. I mean, this is honestly, to me, not that big a story. I mean, it's tragic. It's sensational. I didn't watch it. I didn't read anything about this because I consider mostly this kind of stuff manufactured by the news industry anyway. And, you know, the interviews that are done with the man on the street, they're always saying the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
And they're
mm-hmm.
saying the same thing. And there even have been news stories about this, that they're saying the same things that were said in the last tragedy because they were all watching it. You know, and so there's this, like, really tight feedback loop. The one thing, one very formative event course, in all of our lives was 9/11. And it was especially formative in the blogging world and, you know, by extension, what was, well, if we ever do that again, then it won't be, it'll be, you'll see the connection in a bigger way. I mean, we were covering the story early on without the presence of any news organization on the ground because you were disrupted by the event that was happening. So when something like that happens, I think we will see a big shift immediately in the way the news works. I think right now what we're seeing, you know, is more orchestrated, and it's more business as usual. I mean, you know, the perspective of the Times is still very much, you know, I don't really understand the perspective of the Times, actually. Maybe
that was an interesting thing
to explore, because the news ultimately is being made by the people, by people outside of the Times, right? The Times is kind of a funnel for the voices of those people, right?
I think that there have been, like, a lot of just interesting new approaches
I mean, here you are in an environment where that's all there are voices of the people, right? And so it seems that something much bigger could be done with it than just seeing it as yet another platform for, you know, presenting the story that the Times has always been presenting.
Well, I think that is happening. We were talking, like, very, you know, I was talking very specifically, like, about that news event.
Yeah, let's move off that.
The important thing
is not, you know, I don't think it's emblematic of where we're headed. I think it's a big story. It's the kind of thing that these organizations feed off of. They love it, you know, but that's not rebooting the news, which is what we're focused on.
Yeah, and there, you know, and I think as you know, there, like, many of our journalists are use Twitter very effectively as a tool for their reporting. Brian Stelter, you know, who covers television for us.
Brian is definitely one of the guys that I'm thinking of. In terms
yes.
of somebody who uses it effectively. Yeah.
Yes, and Jenny Wortham, you know, who is at Jenny Deluxe on Twitter, and Brian, who is @BStelter on Twitter. I mean, these are, like, two reporters who, to your point, you know, by following them, you can get kind of, it's like a window onto the process of their reporting. And I do think that many people here believe that there's, you know, a lot of value to offering, like, that window into the process, as well as, you know, it can really, like, help, you know, Brian, Jenny, you know, many, I mean, I'm not, well, Jenny Ately is of course, like, another reporter who has effectively used Twitter for her reporting. You know, they've, like, figured out how to use it, like, to find sources, track trends, and you know, and show the process. But another thing that I don't think would have happened here 18 months ago, the sports department, for example, has been way ahead in using Twitter. You know, Juliette McCaw covered the Tour de France, and she was writing stories for the paper. She was writing stories for the website. She was doing, you know, live blogging. Plus, she had an extraordinarily very active Twitter stream going on. Juliette McCaw, she covers cycling for the New York Times. She covers cycling, and she did a terrific job on the Tour de France. And to your point about giving, you know, our readers, giving our users sort of like a window on the reporting process, I mean, she just brought you right along, you know, on the ride with the Tour de France. And that was a fun and important story for, like, many of our readers. Then I would say also what the sports department did just recently with the World Series. You know, before Twitter lists, we have had this little Twitter module on our blogs where we have tried to, you know, surface tweets and that our reporters are posting. And for the World Series, and this is something like to Jay's point that I don't think anyone like 14 months ago would have said they'd see at the New York Times, in our Twitter module for the World Series, we had reporters from the New York Post, from the New York Daily News, from the Philadelphia Daily News, from the Philadelphia Inquirer, from Los Angeles, from the Boston Globe, you know, from ESPN. We had journalists, all the journalists covering the World Series who were on Twitter. We, you know, grabbed all of those streams and put them in the module, so if you were going to our Bats blog, you didn't just see what Tyler Kepner was writing about the Yankees. You saw what was being written about the the Dodgers.
Okay, I think we get the idea. You guys are integrating new media into your news product.
Well, but the collaboration piece, though, is, you know, that's new, and that's important, and I think it's like, look, as someone who grew up in the city, you know, competing fiercely, I worked at New York Newsday against the New York Times, the Daily News, you know, and the New York Post, like to have this kind of spirit of collaboration around content, I mean, you know,
it's a new thing. Yeah.
That's a totally new thing, and it's like a very cool thing.
Right, but our angle is very different, okay? How we approach this on this show is we're looking at what we call the rebooted news system, and it works differently. One of the main tenets of it is what we call sources go direct.
Mm-hmm.
And that doesn't involve the news industry at all. I mean, it's something the news industry can tap into if it wants to.
Of course.
But I'm not sure there's a whole lot of that going on. I still think that the news industry, very much like the tech industry, by the way, sees itself as the fountain of knowledge that everybody else wants a piece of. So anyway, I don't know. Jay, where do you want to go with this now? I mean, do you have any? Are you there?
Yeah.
I didn't want to focus so much on this one side of things, this show.
I would love to know a little bit about Jennifer's job and how it's evolved since the New York Times in May 2009 announced that it was going to have a social media editor. At that time, Jennifer was, I think it's fair to say, a newcomer to the whole area.
Social media, but not multimedia.
And certainly the idea that the New York Times should have a social media person was a new idea at the time. She's learned a lot since, and I think it would just be interesting to hear the arc of her own lesson learning over that time and how that job actually works, because it's one of the connecting points between the New York Times and our notions of rebooting the news is this job. So I would love to just hear a little bit about how the job has been slowly defined and what you've learned since May as you immersed yourself in the world of social media.
Well, I'll tell you the first thing that I learned is that it's a very public role, which I had not anticipated, because most of the editors who work here, you know, you kind of pride yourself in working behind the scenes and making things happen. So as you both know, I'm glad that I am resilient. You know, it was very rough when I first took on this role. And
how was it rough?
How was it rough?
Yeah, I mean.
Oh, come on.
None of us thought from your point of view. Well, no. I mean, I don't actually know, Jennifer.
No, it was. Look.
Was
I worked at the New York Times.
I don't think.
Look, I work at the New York Times, and I was the first social media, editor, and I was very, very, very new. And what I would recommend to anyone entering this space is that what you do is, is spend some time listening and spend some time learning, spend some time, with you guys, which I have since in the last few months. So I think for anyone stepping into the social media space, that it's important to learn your beat. That's what you learn how to do as a reporter, is like figure out your beat. And I didn't really have that opportunity. I was kind of like thrown into it.
Why does the New York Times, why did that decision at that point? Why did the Times decide that it needed to have a social media editor?
Well, I think that the thinking is that there's a lot going on in this social media space, and the New York Times, wants to be there, and we are there. We have and long before I was named social media editor, we've had like 200, 250, Twitter.
You also had a reporter that was live tweeting an internal meeting at the Times.
Yes. Fortunately, that was before my role.
I understand, it sort of seemed like that had something to do with.
No. I am not the. And John Lemon made that very clear. I am not the Twitter law enforcement official here. I mean, I'm not the Twitter cop. My job here is to bring more of our journalists, like not just, onto Twitter, obviously, but, we're now talking with folks in our culture department and in our design department about, like, how we can do some, like, fun, cool, innovative things on Tumblr. We have a huge presence, now on YouTube. We have 500,000 fans on Facebook. So what can we do to, be where, look, people have had dinner conversations about the New York Times like for decades, right? So we just want to be where those conversations are, whether they're on our site or off.
What you're saying, Jennifer, is that the Times is recognizing that the web is moving from the website to the stream or to the many different streams that people use out there. And for a big news organization like yours, it has to react to that. It has to be in those streams at the same time that it is still putting a lot of effort into its website. And the social media editor is the person who is learning about that and driving that forward. Is that what you're saying?
Yes. And I'm working very closely, with our journalists, because Twitter is not the right tool or platform for everything. Like, for example,
right.
The choice blog. Hey, Facebook. Maybe that's like Facebook is, one could argue, is perhaps like more appropriate, like for, because it's reaching like kids going through the college admissions process. So also think a big part of my role has been working, closely with our developers, and I have found them, frankly, to be like the most innovative, most creative people in the room when it comes to, like thinking about like what we should be doing, where we should be going. Saraya Darabi from our marketing department, has really taken this organization just in all sorts of like wonderful directions with her efforts over the last few years, like with Facebook and now with YouTube. And Jake Harris, of course, was the developer. I mean, the reason why the New York Times is on Twitter, this is just a quick, great little story. Jake wanted a Twitter feed for his cell phone. So he set it up, you know, at New York Times headlines, Twitter feed for his cell phone. And he set it up, you know, on a Mac underneath his desk. And then it grew and grew and grew. No one really paid attention to it. Then one day the cleaning staff knocked over the knocked over the server, and there were all of these complaints. Where's my, you know, New York Times Twitter feed? So that's how we knew we had that there was opportunity there. And now there's more than 2 million, you know, followers. So, look, I don't think anybody pretends to know what it all means, but we're just trying to get out there, be innovative, and play. And, you know, with the help of you guys and with the help of, like, a lot of folks out there, just, like, help figure it out. And, you know, like, the whole spirit of collaboration, I think that, in terms of lesson learned, that's what I have loved about the social, about being in the social space. Now, there's, like, a wonderful sharing. There's, like, a great community out there, like, people who just, you know, want to share tools, want to share ideas. It's just been really terrific.
Would it be fair to say that a significant portion of traffic to NewYorkTimes.com is now coming from Twitter referrals, as it does from Google News?
Oh God! You see, you got the person from the newsroom. So I don't really have all of that information, but from what I understand, is that it's, you know, it's growing. It's growing, but it's not like the single biggest. I mean, of course, searches, and then a huge percentage of our audience just comes directly to our website. But you know, it's growing very quickly, and so that therefore means you got to pay attention to it. And it's just, you know, the whole power of the recommend, I think, is really, really important. And you know, that's going to be very important, of course, like moving forward. And just, you know, it's just kind of neat. I got to tell you, you just do a search of NY Times, you know, on Twitter, and just to see the conversation taking place around the content, it's pretty cool. There's like a lot of great, thoughtful people sharing out there.
Dave, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Yeah, I'm boring him to death. I can tell,
no,
Dave.
No,
I can tell.
Well, no, it's please.
No, but to your point about rebooting the news, is your question about like how we engage our users?
Why don't we
and
talk
citizens?
A little bit about what rebooting the news, Jay? I don't know. Where do we want to go now? We have some other things on our list for this week. There's, you know.
Yeah, let's move on from these questions specifically about the New York Times. I'd love to hear about the droid, which is something Dave's been writing a lot about this week, and sort of the implications of that for the larger news system. I think it's very interesting, but I'm not a participant in it. So why don't you just tell us a little
like
bit
about
it.
You don't like mobile devices, right, Jay? I mean,
no, I don't. I'm kind of...
Do you have a cell phone?
I have a cell phone, but I hate using it, and it's like a plague in my life.
Interesting. So when you, like, if you were to, like, take a trip to California, would you bring a laptop with you?
Yeah.
You would, okay. And, so, yeah, I mean, I carry, I've carried an iPhone. I got an iPhone the day they came out, basically. Before that, I had a BlackBerry. I had a New York Times feed for the BlackBerry, too. This was, like, in 2007, because, you know, because I wanted to keep right, and so then I switched over to the iPhone, and then I'm trying to only keep the story short. I felt it had a lot of promise because at the beginning we didn't know how it's going to work for developers, and so they told us basically if you want to put an application onto the iPhone, then you should make a website, and that was their API. Which was kind of a joke, and when, you know, Apple tells you something like that, you know that it's, you know, there's a pretty good chance that they're going to change the story, and they, of course, did change the story. And so the iPhone, well, it's a beautiful thing to have, and it's functional in certain areas. There are certain things that, like, it'll never do. because it's a very closed system. You have to go through an approval process to get your application onto the iPhone, and there are certain types. Nobody knows what their criteria are for deciding whether an app belongs there or doesn't belong there, and so it's sort of like reading tea leaves. Developers sort of have to try to figure out, well, is this worth investing in? Because if they don't approve your app, your whole investment's lost. And so it's kind of brutal. And so I think a lot of things don't ever get started because people don't want to invest thinking that they're never going to be able to get these apps out there. And so I got a Droid on Friday. And I don't know why this was the moment when I knew, you know, a Droid is the operating system for the phone is created by Google, and the phone is made by Motorola, and the service provider is Verizon. So it's those three companies together.
Got it.
And I could never, like, I'm talking on it right now, and I could never do, I actually did used to do the podcast on my iPhone, and the quality was awful. And, you know, it's a terrible, terrible phone. You know, and immediately this is a lot better. Not a lot of implications for rebooting the news, though. What does have the implications, though, is that it's a wide-open platform, and there is no approval process. You don't have to get anybody's approval, any of those three companies. And all the rules that Apple has, that apps can't do, there are a lot of things that apps can't do on the iPhone. They say it's because you can't have those things running in a cellular phone environment. All those rules, all is probably fine, but at least many of those rules do not apply here. So you can have multiple apps running at the same time. They can be getting information in the background while you're using a different application. I could put this phone on a speaker and run any application I want to on the phone while I'm doing that. But you can't do that on an iPhone. Yeah. So it's a rougher experience. I mean, the user interface is nowhere near as pretty in some areas, and even not as functional as an iPhone is in some ways. But it has this promise to it that the iPhone, unless Apple changes their mind about what the platform is, that the iPhone will never have.
Hmm. So what are you going to do with it?
Well, I started a blog. I've got droidy.com. And because I felt immediately there was not enough information out there for a newbie like myself, and got, you know, three other people writing for it now. And this is all in the space of 2 days. And I don't know, Jay. I mean, it's I don't think I will be myself a developer for it, because, you know, the startup cost of becoming a developer for a new platform is just, it's huge. Mm-hmm. If I were like 25 years old, you know, I might do it. If I really, really, really trusted Google, I might do it, but I don't. You know, I think Google is every bit as evil as Apple is. I think at some point they'll screw with it, and, you know, so while it's a very promising, exciting thing today, I have my doubts about it in the future. So I honestly can't, I don't know the answer to it. But what I do like is that there are other developers out there. You know, it's not even so much about what apps you use and what you do with them. It's the fact that, that people want to work with each other. And, you know, and that's the exciting thing. You know, it's, in the new system, the day I'm looking forward to is when the news is sort of just, it's really collaborative, and everybody's involved in producing it, and that the sources don't feel like their story is being controlled by the press people, which I always feel when I talk to a reporter. You know, the same way, I feel the same way about the this gets back, Jennifer, to, mm-hmm. you know, what I mean by rebooting the news is that I feel the same way about the journalism system as I do about the technology system. And I don't create software for the New York Times anymore, meaning I don't do interviews with New York Times reporters. And that's not, don't feel singled out.
So this doesn't count?
Wait. I want to finish the thought. I don't do interviews with any reporters because the same way I don't do apps for Apple, because my story isn't going to get out there. It's the reporter's version of my story that's going to get out there. So why I like Twitter is because I don't have to get it, the mm-hmm. information mm-hmm. through anybody. I can get mm-hmm. it straight from the person, straight from the source. And I feel that that has more, well, I know it has more integrity than what I get through the news industry. So sort of what I'm looking forward to is the day when the New York Times becomes just another part of the system. And I do see promise for that. Like, that's what I love about what Patrick is doing with his list. I feel truly like Patrick is, well,
Patrick LaForge.
Patrick LaForge. I don't want to go too far. I feel like there's potential that he and I could work together. I like mm-hmm. that, you know, mm-hmm. because I love, as you know, Jennifer, I love the New York Times. I grew up with the Times. It was part of my, you know, upbringing. So, you know, I want the Times to do well, but, you know, anyway. So.
But, and I do think that the Twitter lists just give us an opportunity to get closer to.
No, I don't agree.
What,
I think that,
what you're
no,
talking
I don't
about.
Think I don't think you're doing it though. I think Patrick's lists do that though. I think that because it's an act of authorship, because he's an individual doing it, because he made individual editorial decisions about it, you know, a guy like me has a chance to get onto Patrick's list.
Yeah, but Dave,
well,
that's what our lists are. Our lists are. I'm not sitting there making the list. Good God,
I don't,
that's not what I've. No, it's
can
our
I ask
specific.
You a I know
journalists
I don't want to make this
are
about
making
me.
The list.
I don't want to make this about me, but am I on the tech news list on the New York Times?
I'm going to have to go. Go.
See, now I am on Patrick's list, and I don't think that's just my ego. I think that a publication like the New York Times doesn't trust a guy like me,
Dave,
I don't know
if
why.
If I ever get 5 minutes to make my own list, I'm like, you know, the shoemaker here. So I haven't had a chance to make my own list.
No,
you,
but
my
point.
Dear, will be on it for sure.
And I believe you, but that's you see, there's the point. I think that almost gets it. And believe me, it's not going to make my career or break it.
I know. I'm joking.
It's not what it's about. It's not my ego. It's that there is your emblem. Why is it that the New York Times doesn't trust me?
Well, I didn't know, Dave, that the New York Times didn't trust you, and maybe I've made a mistake these last few months. What do you think, Jay? Like, trusting him. What do you think? I've been listening to him.
Well, No. All right, maybe I overspoke. Maybe I led with my heart too much there, or, you know, because it is an interesting question. Would I make it onto Patrick LaForge's technology list and not onto the New York Times's?
Well, there isn't such a thing as like a New York Times, you know, list. Our goal is for our journalists to own these lists, like the Media Decoder list, that's Brian Stelter's list. Our technology list, that's the list that was like created by the reporters, you know,
at the Bits blog, right?
At the Bits blog, you know,
right.
Tara Parker Pope's list, you know, that's her list, and it's really not a health list.
Can I ask you a question? I mean, I don't want to put you on the spot, but does it say that on the list? That this is the ownership, these things are owned by these individuals?
Yeah, if
is
you go to nytimes.com, Twitter, because we created a landing page because we realized the functionality that you get in Twitter itself does not allow for any description.
Yeah, I know.
We created this landing page just so that people could see, like Nick Kristof's list about, you know, it's like a cool list. It's like about, you know, accounts and people he follows, you know, who are involved in women's issues and global poverty. So that's Nick Kristof's list. I mean, the goal is to have our reporters, you know, own these lists. Update.
Just got to let you know we have 60 seconds left on the show, so.
Well,
I'm
the big picture here is that open systems don't work like closed systems, and the news system, including the New York Times system, is moving in steps toward a more and more open environment. And
I think that's correct.
That's all to the good, but it also means there's a lot of puzzles and challenges along the way, and we're certainly grateful that Jennifer Preston was willing to come on and share some of those puzzles with us this week. So it was really good having you.
Thank you.
Well, I totally agree. Thank you very much, Jennifer.
Thank you, Dave.
Well, you still have 15 seconds.
And we're all going to
sing a song.
We're all going to keep rebooting the news, right?
Yeah. Let's reboot.
There you go.
See you all next week.
Okay.
Alrighty.
Have a great
Thank
one.
You.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.